Frames of Reference.
Three films, two cinephiles, one podcast.
Cinema is my secret passion.
It's a foreign movie. A film is what it is.
But art films make people feel funny.
This film was a personal vision, not a marketing machine.
We're getting too many mainstream movies.
Episode 6, Sound Speed. All right. Well, we've made it to number 6.
We have, in a tonal shift from our last episode.
Not everything is sunshine and butterflies. Sometimes it's murder.
Ain't that just the way?
I'm Kyle Mahaney.
I'm Sarah Page.
And this is Frames of Reference, the show where we look at three films linked by either theme or director and talk about them and talk about them as a package.
So what have we got on the agenda for today, Kyle?
Today we're looking at films that all use audio recording as a plot device. We're going to be looking at Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, Brian De Palma's Blowout, and Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's The Lives of Others.
These three films are kind of a shift in gears compared to our last episode where we talked about Jacques Demy's very beautiful, wonderful musicals and La La Land and how it fits into that. And this movie kind of almost makes it return to that the voyeurism discussions we had.
In a lot of ways, it does. Also, it's a real shift back into realism, even if there's surrealist elements of all of them.
Yeah. Breaks over, kids. Back to reality.
We've done our fun episode. So all of these films, they deal with, you know, this central element of having a tape recorder rolling, observing conversations that were not intended to be heard. Or conversations or events that were not intended to be heard. They all go about it in a kind of different ways that are both products of their time and also products of their different experiences with genre. Blowout is a noir. The Conversation is this, you know, new American drama from the 70s. And The Lives of Others is very much like a historical piece. And it has a lot of thriller elements that the others dabble in, but it goes all in on the suspense. We have characters who have these very parasocial relationships with the people that they are listening to or the events that they are listening to. And the viewer and the protagonist are the only ones who have all the information. And the story is kind of wrapped up in who has the facts, who knows what they know. So that's kind of a very compelling suspense element, I find.
Yeah, I really love how all three of these movies, when you lay it out on paper, have very similar like pitches, but they all deal with the story differently. And I also, just going back to the voyeurism that we've talked about before, I do really love it when movies do things that make the audience implicated in the events of the movie. Like, we have so much in common with these main characters who are hearing these very personal conversations. And like, yes, it's a movie, but we're still participating in a degree of parasocial relationships, a degree of voyeurism and things like that. So I always love thinking about that. So it was nice to return back to another set of films that was like, let's, you know, have a character deeply dig into the lives of other people without their knowledge.
So let's start with The Conversation first. So this is directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It came out in 1974, which is fairly early in his career, just as he was really hitting, you know, the main stage. He came out in between The Godfather 1 and The Godfather 2. It's really in this like finest period of not only Coppola's work, but also the new Hollywood movement in general. It's regarded as one of his true masterpieces, being nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay, as well as Best Sound that year, though it won none of them. It did, however, win a BAFTA Award for Best Editing and Best Soundtrack that year, in addition to other nominations. The notable part of that is that legendary editor Walter Murch, who wrote probably the most important book on film editing out there, was not only the editor, but also the sound editor for the film. He came from a background of sound design, and this is his transition into editing cinema. And since sound plays such an important role in this movie, a lot of attention was paid to how the sound design works, how the effects are produced, and how everything is recorded and sounds. So it's interesting that that got those accolades from the British Film Association. It also won the Grand Prix du Festival, what we now call the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and made a lot of critics lists and continues to make a lot of critics lists as it's reviewed very favorably as one of Coppola's more accessible works. It does have a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, so that's a, another indication of how respected it is. However, it's a little difficult to get a copy of. In the US, it is totally out of print on Blu-ray, with it going for quite a bit of money. However, there is a much superior Blu-ray that has a better encode and the correct aspect ratio available from Studio Canal in the UK and the rest of Region B. However, it is region locked, so you need to have a region free player. As always, we highly recommend having a region free player because it allows you much more flexibility in finding movies like this. And you can easily import a copy of the Region B release from various importers like Orbit DVD, where we got our copy, which ships directly from North Carolina. The movie's also streaming on Paramount Plus.
It stars Gene Hackman as Harry Call. This is also Harrison Ford's second real film role after Lucas American Graffiti. Fun fact, Ford was considered for Demi's Model Shop, but the studio executives felt that Ford had no future in film business and told Demi that he needed to hire a more experienced actor, which is such an interesting, like, little factoid to look back on now.
He wasn't good looking enough, apparently. That was another component of that. And Demi referred him to two kids, essentially, who admired Demi and the rest of the French New Wave while Demi was living in Hollywood, George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola. And that's how Ford wound up getting cast in both of those movies.
I love that. But also just sidebar, the fact that anyone looked at Harrison Ford and said he's not attractive enough for camera, needs their eyes checked.
In a way, Jacques Demy is responsible for Han Solo by introducing him to George Lucas.
That is, to me, a very wild fact that I would not have believed if you had told me. Just the picturing the just comparison of, like, the films that I've seen Harrison Ford in compared to, like, Demy, the two Demy films we talked about last week.
Yeah.
Completely different.
Can you imagine Ford in a Demy musical? That was the intention.
I want it so much. In a parallel universe where Guillermo del Toro's Hobbit lives, there is also a parallel universe where Ford is in a Demi musical.
Also a parallel universe where Model Shop is a good musical.
Ooh.
But so back on the conversation, this is very much, it's a very unique film of its time in the way that it uses audio recording as a core element. The film began shooting in 1972 in the midst of the early days of the Watergate investigation reports. So it really has a lot of paranoia about the government that feels very timely for the late days of the Vietnam War and the downfall of the Nixon administration. It also is heavily influenced by Antonioni's British realist film Blow Up, which also obviously is an influence on Brian De Palma's Blow Out, which we'll be talking about next. So that's kind of an interesting historical context to where this film sits. Ultimately, it's a movie about espionage at its core. And in an era where espionage usually means action movies like James Bond, this is almost the polar opposite of that. This is a film about surveillance. People who sit in vans or hotel rooms or offices listening to what other people are saying. That is their entire life. In this case, we follow surveillance expert Harry Call, who is a private contractor taking mostly corporate, we're led to assume, espionage gigs in San Francisco. He has a background in wiretapping and has kind of this murky past, as you'd expect from anyone working in the sector. And they're conducting a fairly complicated wiretapping operation following a couple through Union Square that involves a lot of moving parts and is quite a technically intense process. So when we first introduce these characters and what's happening, we see the process, the conversation being recorded from dozens of microphones with many moving people. There's people following them through the square. There's microphones out of windows. It is a high stakes, very involved production. And it's very easy to get caught up in the production aspects of that and not think about why are they being recorded and what is the conversation. Call is a gun for hire. He doesn't really know the client. He doesn't know the reason they're being recorded. He is just an observer. He is detached. He tries not to think about that. So days later, he edits together the tape. So he has a composite of what actually was said from all the microphones. And he has this clear recording of what they were saying that seems utterly ambiguous and lacking meaning. We pull out a little bit to see more of Call's life. He is a privacy nut. His apartment is absolutely bare other than security features. He does not have a phone. He uses a payphone to make all his calls. His office is literally enclosed in a cage in a warehouse and is entirely Spartan. He has no visual art. He seems to have no friends. His girlfriend seems to know nothing about him. And his only hobby or expression that we really see is that he plays his collection of jazz records while he plays along on his sax alone by himself in his apartment. That's already some red flags, but he seems content in his life, and he seems honestly quite satisfied. He's good at his job and he seems fulfilled by that job. He's not interested in the mechanisms of why he is surveilling these people. He is just a very talented person at the act of surveillance. He is not responsible for what happens to the people being surveilled or what people do with the information gleaned from that. He is a gun for hire. This morality seems at odds with his intense Catholicism. And we kind of struggle with that in perception until a colleague starts to ask questions about a prior gig that results in the death of multiple people. And we see that this is all a carefully constructed facade to cover up the fact that he has unaddressed trauma related to the realities of the work he does. And we start to get the sense that the perception we're seeing of his life is not entirely honest. Call attempts to deliver the recording to the client that contracted him of these two people having a conversation in the square. And the director who conducted the arrangement is not there. So he refuses to hand over the tapes. He starts to kind of get these spidey senses that something's not right and gets intimidated by the assistant who tells him not to get involved, which makes him want to get more involved. And, you know, this assistant says the tapes are dangerous and is very intense in trying to force the issue so that the tapes will be handed over directly to the assistant. But Call is, you know, not gonna do that. He's only going to hand over the information to the people who contracted it directly. So he turns to leave with the tapes to make the drop another time. And as he's leaving the building, he sees both of the targets he was surveilling in the office. He starts to become increasingly concerned about the material and what will happen to them. So he becomes obsessed with listening to this recording over and over again, filtering it, trying to understand more and more of what they said. And he uncovers a new phrase that he wasn't able to discern prior due to the cover of music obscuring the recording, where someone says that, quote, "he'd kill us if he got the chance." Call starts to believe these people are in danger. So he stalls on turning over the tape and starts becoming intensely paranoid that he is being followed and bugged. People are listening to him. He has a party with other industry professionals that gets a little out of hand in his office. And we get to unpack a little bit more of his character and his reputation in the industry and his past successes, which might be to the damage of his own personal integrity. Eventually, there is a prostitute who had been invited to the party somehow, who stays and sleeps with Call. When he wakes up in the office, the prostitute is gone, along with the master tape of his recording. He then visits the director, who is his client, and learns that the woman in the recording is, in fact, the director's wife, who is having an affair with the man in the recording. Fearing that they are truly in danger, he books a hotel room next to the one that was planned in the recording and uses his equipment to bug their room. He hears the director have a heated argument with his wife and eventually witnesses a bloody hand slam against a glass partition on an outdoor balcony. he believes that he has witnessed the wife being murdered. He retreats, utterly shocked and, you know, guilty that he wasn't able to stop it. He breaks into the room once they've left to find the evidence of the murder and finds nothing except for the toilet, which appears to overflow with bloody water when he flushes it. Call suddenly goes to confront the director at his office, but he's not there. And as he goes to leave the office building, he's surprised to notice that his wife is alive and unharmed in a limousine leaving the office building. Later that day, he reads in a newspaper that the director was killed in a car accident. And he realizes that in reality, the couple were planning the director's murder. And he witnessed the murder of the director, not his wife. He gets a phone call after this realization from the assistant telling him not to look into the matter further and that they'll be listening, which then plays back a recording of the saxophone piece he had just been playing. He tears apart his apartment frantically, searching for a bug that he's not able to find. And we're left with a man in his destroyed apartment, utterly ravaged by paranoia. And we don't even know if the blood that he saw was real. We don't know what he knew. He's an unreliable narrator. He has ruined his life over suspicion.
I find the kind of descent into, for lack of a better term, descent into madness that this character has very interesting, because the line of work he's chosen, which has been chosen because he is very, like, he's very skilled and clearly has an innate interest in the art of espionage. Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, he chose this life and then the guilt and consequences of the line of work that he does slowly starts to catch up with him. And then he kind of hones in on this one conversation for this one client.
Yeah.
And the way it just falls apart for him, because at the end of the day, interestingly enough, the man who had all the information, you know, he's a guy who collects all this information. He didn't have enough about this to make the correct judgment on what the circumstances of that conversation was. But yeah, there's some kind of irony I find for a character who has all the information to turn out to be the one who didn't.
Yeah, no, have someone have who's so confident part. in having the answers, actually having insecurity. And I think that translates not only to him not knowing the facts of what's happening here with the case he's observing. I think also that translates to the faith element. He has a lot of confidence in his, if there's one thing he is rigid on, it's his religion. We see it multiple times in the film. And yet he has guilt and doubt that he hasn't been able to find a satisfactory atonement for himself.
Yeah, he's like this very devout person of faith, but, and he's haunted by, you know, guilt for the consequences of that other case that he had that resulted in, I believe, a few multiple deaths.
Yep.
And so with that hanging over him, it overshadows the choices he makes for this case in almost a way that you might interpret it as him at the last minute trying to change something to atone for the previous events. But he doesn't get that relief. He doesn't get to do anything to atone for it.
Well, it's like surveillance is a dirty job.
Yeah.
And that is the nature of the job. And he projects outwardly that he is entirely comfortable with that and is not bothered by it. But inside, mm-hmm. we can see that it's eating him up. And I think that's really interesting. In some ways, you know, Coppola has made it pretty clear that Blow Up was a big influence on him. And the way in Blow Up that we see the protagonist be, he's a photographer in an era where, especially in the British press, photographers had very few restrictions on them. And he's satisfied with his ability to, as an artist, to document things around him, and becomes increasingly obsessed with the possibilities of how that can go wrong and what he might or might not have seen. I think those parallels are very strong there. Parallels to Lovecraft, the descent into madness over questioning one's own perception. I see a lot of comparisons to kind of weird tales in the 1920s in a film that doesn't have anything traditionally genre associated with those kinds of works.
Yeah, especially going off that a little bit, the fact that his entire like identity as a professional is based on his ability to hear and to see and to filter important information about the world. Mm-hmm. The fact that he, at the end of the movie, is revealed both to himself and the audience as actually being an unreliable narrator makes you forced to question him and what he sees at the end, even down to the we'll be listening to you.
You don't know if that's real.
Are they? You don't know if they're actually listening to him or if he's finally had
a break.
And then he's just
a mad person who has torn apart his apartment for no reason.
Exactly. And the fact that his job, his career, his life's work has been built on the ability to find reliable information and to filter and see and hear like reliable information.
Yeah.
That kind of just descent for me was very like, I found it very tonally impactful.
Yeah. It's also incredibly tense.
Mm-hmm.
Until the revelation that it's a false, that it's an unreliable narrator, you feel intensely concerned for these subjects because you don't know how he's going to intervene and you don't morally trust him to intervene.
And he's also portrayed by other characters in the story as very reliable. He is top of his business.
And very detached.
His colleagues respect him. And yeah, he doesn't get involved emotionally.
Yeah. And then that all gets thrown in the head when we realize that he's having visions that might or might not have happened, that everything's not adding up to be nice and neat. And you're engaged for the entirely different reason if you don't know what's real. And this film doesn't really give you a satisfying ending as of that.
No, it just kind of hands you the end and it's like, here you go. Ruminate on that. An interesting kind of to pivot here. One thing that I really like about this movie, and I also really like it about Blowout, but the way that like the technical aspects of recording sound is portrayed without bogging it down with like explanations. You're just shown what they're doing.
And it's a ritual. It is a ritual. Yes. There is nuance and detail and art in the ritual they are doing. Both examples I can think of are scenes of them syncing up multiple types, multiple signals of tape without having time code to line it up. And there's something intensely mechanical. You understand these people who work with their hands and are very skilled at their job, and that there is a lot going on here. As someone who, you know, has been a professional editor, has worked on a moviola, has done manual by tape editing, that is a huge time commitment to be able to do that well. And they make it like watching an artist at work, how these people are able to do their jobs to observe this audio.
Yeah, they present it so well, too. Like, you are able to absorb.
You're not bogged down by technicality.
Yeah, no one's stopping to, like, stop and explain everything to you. You are just carried along by it because they are professionals. They're artists. They're doing what they've always been doing.
I do find it amusing that apparently the microphones and recorders used in the conversation are the exact same models that were used by Richard Nixon's Ratfuckers. That's just product of its time, but kind of haunting.
Yeah, that is spooky. I think it's very interesting that in all three of these movies, the main characters, the voyeurs, the ones who are listening in, are all such profoundly alone people.
Yeah, they're all, you know, I think today if we were to portray these characters, we would be asking questions about like whether they're an incel. They're all single. They're all very antisocial, especially in the conversation, the lives of others. They're all very lonely and eagerly latching on to connection from other people.
So, but in a lot of ways as well, taking a step back from like an incel read, you can also read any moviegoer and any person who like, I feel like onto these as well. Like,
mm-hmm.
There's a very parasocial relationship that these people develop with the people that they're listening to. And I think in a lot of ways, like Peeping Tom did, the film is a little bit like, this could be anyone.
And the relationship we have with things we see in a movie is very similar. We're not able to affect it. We can only observe and draw mm-hmm. our own conclusions.
Exactly.
The conversation is also important when we look at it in the context of New American Cinema, when it is slow cinema, quite frankly, not compared to a lot of things we look at today, but it doesn't have the kind of pacing that you would expect from a lot of Hollywood productions of the 50s or 60s. It does not play all of its cards in a timely fashion. It does not leave you with satisfying answers. It is auteur cinema that is willing to explore ideas without knowing exactly what its conclusions are going to be, and have characters that don't follow traditional archetypes.
Thinking about it as an espionage movie, the way that it is so much more, you know, insidious and realistic to what actual espionage is in real life, because it's not James Bond.
It doesn't make espionage sexy. It makes it scary.
It does. It makes it scary. This, I'm not going to lie, after I finished these movies, I was like, okay, I feel a little spooky right now, even though none of the stories are like supposed to be quote unquote scary. They're not horror movies, but they are unsettling with the ease at which characters are able to access other people's extremely personal lives.
Yeah. And it's very much all three of these films take place during eras where very physical surveillance of people was common in espionage. Obviously, today our world is very different with most communication happening on the internet, where the internet, that's a whole different conversation for how you observe people. So if anything, it feels almost quaint to have a man sitting listening to a recording in the next room. But the intimacy with which this observation occurs is very uncomfortable. They know every detail about the lives they're observing. I also think genre is really interesting because, like I said, this is, you know, New Hollywood. It is a adult drama of the 1970s. It doesn't play too much with genre tropes. It could just as easily be All the President's Men or The Graduate as far as how it is directed. It's very straightforward, character-driven storytelling. This could easily have been a noir film like Blowout and have totally different trappings. But Coppola isn't interested in the plot elements like that. Coppola is interested in the interpersonal elements of it. And it instead focuses entirely on the character and where he is emotionally and what his reactions are, instead of necessarily what's happening around him. And I think that's a very unique part of this.
Yeah, the very tight, very close tie that the viewer has to Harry Call specifically throughout the movies makes it unique actually from the other two films, where we do take a step back and follow other characters for portions, especially for large portions of the lives of others.
Yeah.
We aren't just seeing the story through that voyeur's perspective, that intelligence agent's perspective. Whereas in The Conversation, we pretty much stick with Call the entire time. The reality is filtered through him.
And everything we observe is reacting against him. I also think there's a real cynicism to this movie that was not common in cinema just a few years prior. Again, you know, we talk about how grounded and realistic not only the new American cinema was until we get to later things like Star Wars, but also how cynical about the state of the world they are compared to prior generations. This is not a positive portrayal of society. This is a very harsh look at our world and secrets and dangers. It has more in common with, say, Hitchcock than a lot of contemporary films of that era. And even something like a Hitchcock film usually has this moralist ending of the good guys and the bad guys. We don't have a good guy here. We're left with a very stark look of shades of gray. And we don't truly know if any character is morally redeemable.
Yeah, and I like that the film doesn't try to decide for you how to feel about these things. Like, it is a very serious and a very unkind, maybe, look at the world. But I like that the film just sort of leaves you, in many ways, untethered, like Call is. You're just left to ruminate on what has happened.
So that is The Conversation. One thing I forgot to mention when we're talking about availability is there is a new 35mm restoration that's making a tour across the United States. So if you have that coming to your city, definitely take the time to see it. I saw it in New York this summer, and it's a really beautiful restoration of a film that is not available currently in a lot of other ways right now. So definitely, if you're able to see it on actual celluloid, it's a wonderful way to experience it. Moving on now to Brian De Palma's Blowout. This came out in 1981 on the heels of many successful De Palma films, most notably Carrie. It has an 87% Rotten Tomatoes. And as far as availability, it has a recent 4K release from Criterion, which absolutely blows away every other version of this movie. That is only available in the US. And make sure you get the 4K disc, because the previous Blu-ray from Criterion is not nearly as good. In the UK, it has a release from Arrow, which is the same older transfer as the original Criterion Blu-ray. And just import the 4K from the US. It's miles better. There's a lot of damage on that original release. For streaming, your only option is Cinemax. So might as well just pick up physical media. The film stars John Travolta and Nancy Allen, and is all shot in the city of Philadelphia, which features pretty heavily into the plot. So in this film, John Travolta plays a guy named Jack, who is a sound man for a small, sleazy film production company in Philadelphia. He's working on a bunch of slasher films, doing the Foley and sound design for them, as well as the field sound. And one night, he's told by his producer to go obtain more realistic sounding Foley effects, particularly the scream. They're looking for a better scream and better wind sounds. So he grabs his little Nagra tape recorder and a big shotgun mic and sets off. So that night, he goes to nearby Wissahickon Park to record Foley sound effects. He's capturing those wind effects that he was looking for. And we see him actually observe a young couple and overhear their conversation using the large shotgun microphone he has. So we have this kind of lens that he could misuse the technology he's using to be a spy, to be a peeping Tom. But that is not what's going to happen to him tonight, because he's actually capturing. He moves on. He's capturing the sounds of the frogs and the bugs and the birds and the wind, when all of this is interrupted by a car careening off the road and plunging into the creek. He dives into the water to help rescue someone from the car. However, the driver is already dead. Instead, he's able to break the window and rescue a young woman in the car and take her to the hospital. As soon as we cut to the hospital, something starts to suggest that it's not quite right. The detective interviewing him about the accident seems as if he's constructing his own truth of the accident and seems a little nervous. He doesn't seem very interested in the woman herself. It feels almost more like a cover-up. And we learn that Governor McGryan was the man killed in the accident. He is destined to be the future star of one of the political parties and expected to be the next president, which he's running for. That you can't help but draw comparisons at this point to Chappaquiddick. And I think the film leans into those comparisons, along with comparisons to Watergate. Sally, we learn, was an escort for an event that evening, who was with him. And Jack goes to try to warn Sally that in the hospital that, you know, people are trying to cover it up, that people are trying to conceal her from the story. But she is, quite frankly, drugged up and not in a state to really have that conversation. So the associates of McRyan, his political staffers, are really pressuring Jack to just take her out of the hospital and get her out of there before more press show up. Press who might not be as willing to be on their payroll and tell a favorable account of the story. So they go to a motel and have this, you know, very, very awkward situation of Jack going into a hotel with a woman who's barely even conscious. And he stays up all night listening to the audio he recorded on his Nagra recorder of the accident. He's obsessively playing it back. He's obsessively playing it back over and over again, because we can hear a gunshot just before the sound of a tire blowing out, which caused the vehicle to go off the road and over the rail. We see him become increasingly convinced that this was not an accident, but an assassination. And he realizes that he and Sally are the only witnesses to this event. So we as an audience begin to feel the paranoia. Sometime after this, a news report comes out that shows that there was actually a third person present for this accident. a local photographer, Manny Karp, who is in the park that night and filmed it all with his 16 millimeter movie camera. And Karp has been selling the stills to local tabloids at a very high rate. Again, with the Kennedy comparisons, that even there's even a reporter who compares it to the Zapruder film. Jack is able to go into an animation studio at his work and photograph all of these images out of a tabloid and assemble it into a crude duplicate negative to analyze the footage synced up to his own audio and see the flash of a gunshot at the same time as the sound of the gunshot. He is now utterly convinced that this is what happened. And he shows it to Sally, and she reluctantly agrees to help him look into the matter together because they're both involved in it. They have drinks and it's kind of like a meet cute flirty moment almost. And we get to learn a little bit more that he used to be a technical support staff for a government commission investigating corruption in the police. And he left that line of work after a wiretapping operation went wrong and led to the death of an undercover cop. And it's very clear he's carrying a lot of trauma from that. He doesn't do that kind of gig anymore. You also can sense that he's very suspicious of authority and how deep corruption can go because he's seen it firsthand. What Sally is not telling him at that time is that she and Karp were collaborators planning to blackmail the governor and working for his opposition. The ties to rat fucking operations like Watergate are really strong here. You can't help but feel like this is the kind of thing that would happen from Richard Nixon. The name Nixon is never spoken, but it's kind of a consistent presence, even though we're a decade past Nixon's presidency. You can't help but draw those comparisons to, you know, the Kennedy years, to Ted Kennedy, to Ed Muskie, to that entire generation of political deceit. The film never says the names, but you're just kind of left with that as a comparison. So while all of this is happening, we learn through alternate perspectives that Burke, the mastermind behind both Sally being in the car with McRyan and Karp, the photographer who was photographing them, is a hired agent, as I said, for the rival party. And he has gone rogue from that campaign's leadership and has decided to actually blow out McRyan's tire with a gunshot instead of just getting the saucy photos of him with an escort. Obviously, that's way more heat than the opposing campaign wants, and they're kind of horrified. And the authorities seem to be getting closer. There's a lot going on here, and we find out that this guy, Burke, is also covering up for what will eventually be him taking out Sally by murdering various lookalike women and becoming notorious in the Philadelphia Fit papers as a serial killer. He's murdering them with piano wire, and the local papers run with the title of the Liberty Bell Strangler. So that's an element here. This is in the lead up to July 4th, where obviously there's a lot of festivities going on surrounding the Founding Fathers and Independence Day in Philadelphia. So it kind of plays into the local narrative and becomes a hot button issue in local discourse and becomes a notable news story that people are paying attention to. So when Sally is eventually in danger, no one's going to ask questions about possible connections to the politics of it. Sally has stolen Karp's original film of the murder to help Jack. So he now has taken his little moviola and synced up his audio to a high quality original chrome of the original chrome film of the murder and is able to clearly show that it is a gunshot that occurs. But no one really seems to believe his story. And he's not able to really get any traction outside of one local talk show host, Frank Donahue, who agrees to interview him on air and release the tapes. There's been some nefarious things happening with copies of his tapes being erased, including a copy he'd given to the police. So he is intensely protective of this new synced duplicate he's made. And because it is the original film and he doesn't have time to go to a lab and get it duplicated properly, this is now the only copy with that motion picture to go along with the film. He's very nervous about handing it over to anyone, let alone the media who might be in on this conspiracy. There's some oddities going on regarding the plans to meet up. Donahue wanted Sally to also go on the air, but she was initially hesitant about it. But we find out that Burke has actually tapped Jack's phones and is intercepting calls for him. And he calls Sally as Donahue and talks her into meeting up for an exchange of the tapes at the train station, 30th Street Station, downtown Philadelphia. At this point, Jack's phones are out of order because of Donahue's meddling. So he's been out of the loop for hours. And when Sally shows up, the plan is kind of already in motion and he has to scramble and isn't able to do his due diligence to inspect whether this is legitimate or not. They drive over to 30th Street Station, finding parking directly across the street from the station. Got to point that out. And Jack has wired Sally as if he would wire a cop in an investigation. And he's going to be staying at a distance with the recorder, listening in on what's happening in case anything fishy is happening. We see that Burke is in the station already, and he actually kills a prostitute who looks like Sally right before she arrives. So, again, we're building up this pattern to be able to distract from the actual political aspirations of the murders and just present it as another murder and another serial killer in Philadelphia in the 1970s. Sally enters the station and makes contact with the person she believes is Donahue, but is actually Burke. Things are not going as they should. He starts to remove her to the train platform, and it's not Donahue's voice. So Jack is alarmed and tries to chase after her. And just as he's going after her, they start to slip in and out of range. And he knows that they got on a subway and he has to try to follow her. They wind up going downtown to where the parade for Independence Day is happening. Jack figures out roughly where they're headed and manically drives across the city, avoiding all laws, going through buildings. It's an incredible action sequence. But it all comes head to head with him crashing his Jeep while avoiding a parade float, and he is knocked unconscious. By the time he is awakened, Burke has taken the film from Sally and destroyed it by throwing it into the river, and he has now taken her to a rooftop and is attacking her. Jack comes to and tries to reach them, tries to desperately get help, but he's left with the only thing he can do is listen in on his earpiece while watching from a distance as she is brutally murdered. It isn't until after that he's able to reach Burke and stab him himself with Burke's own weapon, but it is too late. Sally is dead. Jack is devastated and crushed, and we're kind of at the end of the story. The truth will never be known. He is the only one left who truly knows it. The tapes are not enough evidence to prove what happened. The film has been destroyed. So Jack is just left repeatedly listening to a recording he made of Sally's voice that he has become obsessed with. He has nothing left. He is a broken shell of a man. The film ends with a scene a few months later where he's in the editing room again, finishing the same movie. And the producer, who was previously unsatisfied with the scream sounds, is listening to a scream that is absolutely haunting and blood-curdling as Jack looks morosely on. It is Sally's death scream as recorded from the lavalier microphone on her when she was murdered. The producer is ecstatic at Jack's work. It's perfect. And he keeps looping the sound back over and over again, so in love with the sound. And Jack is so distraught, he has to cover his ears. And that's where we're left. What a film.
Yeah, it definitely does not leave you in a happy place. It's the way that Sally's death, especially, overshadows the loss of the tapes for me, that really emotionally hits you at the end. Because for most of the movie, the whole point is getting these tapes to the right people, getting out the word. And then at the very end, when Sally is murdered, that death just totally overshadows the loss of the tapes.
Well, Jack's in love with her at that point.
Yeah. Oh, so sad. There was a moment when, because again, like, I hadn't seen this film before, so I didn't know how it was going to end. And there was kind of a moment where I was like, he's not going to make it, is he? Because I had been holding on, you know, I'm a hopeful person. And so I've been like holding on to like a hope that he would like at the last possible second save her. And then there's like a moment where he's literally pushing through the crowd, like desperately trying to reach her.
He's done.
And you kind of just know, you're like, oh, this is futile.
The world isn't going to help him. The world is not a kind place. Yeah. No, it's not a feel good movie at all.
No, I did not feel good finishing this movie. I do love one thing I really like about this movie and the conversation is just to go back to like the technical aspect of filmmaking and the technical aspect of sound recording is the fact that they both give very, you know, competent, interesting, artistic portrayals of the art of recording and the art of filmmaking without it being too self-congratulatory. Look at us. We're so cool making our movies in our movie. You know what I mean?
It is technically accurate without getting caught up in technical minutiae.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting look at a very high-tech era where everything had changed a lot in the last 10 years as far as how we do field sound in movies. But everything would utterly change in the next 10 years.
Yeah. The other thing is the way so many plot elements in all three of these movies only works because of the time in which they were made, because you couldn't.
No cell phones. Yeah. No easy duplication. It's on like the film is on film. It's not videotape. Yeah. You have to rely on a lab. A decade later, the editing would be digital on a computer. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe likely digital on a computer. The audio would be a digital file or a DAT tape. And the footage would likely have been shot on videotape, easily duplicated. It doesn't pan out. This is such a product of its time in how the execution can work.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that De Palma was very upfront that this was his retelling of Blow Up, when Blow Up really hinges on our protagonist being an unreliable narrator, much like the conversation. Here, instead, we deal with basically the same plot premise, but with utter realism. We have no doubt that Jack knows the truth, that Jack is in his right mind, that Jack is the one person who actually has all the facts, and we are never led to doubt that. The world is a cruel place, and he alone has the information to expose its cruelty. And, you know, Blow Up and The Conversation both play with this to make you doubt that the observer actually is reliable in what they're seeing. Jack, we have no reason to believe he isn't experiencing exactly how it's been presented to us.
And the tragedy of him being trapped with this knowledge that no one will ever believe, he can never tell the world. He is fully in his right mind, yep. But he is in a way like trapped because of the information he knows. And he's trapped with the reality.
And it very much plays with the idea of political dynasty and the power that comes with that. You know, again, it's a film made in the early 80s with a lot of very direct references to Chappaquiddick. You can't help but think of the Kennedy family and their sphere of influence on politics in Massachusetts and the pressures that came with that. And you know that this is going to continue, that this kind of relationship pressure is going to happen, and he's going to have to see not only the people who were responsible for this gain power through politics, but also the possibility of what could have been, and you know that the figure that the politician who dies is going to be memorialized in ways that are not entirely accurate as well to his own character. So there's a real loss of truth throughout the entire movie. Jack knows reality, and no one will ever believe him, and he will not be able to tell anyone or prove anything.
And he just has to go on living with the knowledge that this kind of thing will be happening, you know, again.
Again.
To other people.
It also is very direct in its criticism of kind of the if it bleeds, it leads culture, and how bloodthirsty our culture is. We see this in how the news media is portrayed, but we also see this in how cinema is portrayed. The idea that a movie is better when it features an actual death. It's no surprise that De Palma has also cited Peeping Tom as a big influence on this movie. Who are we if a movie is more enjoyable for us when it features that kind of pure anguish?
Yeah. I think it's interesting as well, like the genre of film that he's working on. It's like a...
Yeah, it's neo-noir. Yeah. This is actually honestly like a pretty early example of this kind of neo-noir. And it has all those classic noir trappings of basically a team of detectives. They're not actually professional detectives, but that's who they are. And they only know the truth, and there are people out to get them. So they have to use subterfuge and intrigue to try to bring truth to the masses. That is what this movie is. And what makes it so transformative is the fact that they are unable to succeed. They fail, and it is devastating, and they have to live with those consequences. And they have to live with guilt. I do love just how Philadelphia lives and breathes in this film. You know, you see the Terminal Market, you see 30th Street Station, you see, you know, historic Philly, you see SEPTA, which is odd because the SEPTA always seems to be reliable in this movie. And clean. It's such a honest and earnest portrayal of Philadelphia that doesn't seem like it is exaggerated like some other films. It just feels very lived in and like a real place full of that has a lot of integrity in how it's portrayed.
Yeah. And to go off that, I also think the way the characters are written in this movie is really, considering the fact that it's a very plot driven story with a lot of different mechanics moving around. So characters aren't going to be as driven. But I think the film does a really nice job with both Jack and Sally of, you know, learning more about them as the movie goes on. We don't know anything about Jack when we first meet him on that bridge when he records that murder. But as we follow him, like learning about how he used to work with undercover cops and why he is the way he is now. And then same with Sally, you know, the guilt that she carries with her. I just think that the film doesn't spend a lot of time doing a lot of character work, but it's really efficient with the character details that they give us, that along with the actors' performances makes them feel like real people without bogging down the story with a bunch of backstory.
It knows when to lean into archetypes so that we understand the archetypes. We understand who people are, so we can focus instead on the depth that they bring to those archetypes. I also think it has the benefit of being a little more removed from the political events of the early 70s, so it can be a little more direct, and also have like the lens of time compared to something like The Conversation. You know, this came out a decade after Chappaquiddick. It came out, you know, 7 or 8 years after Watergate. People have had time to write their books, have had time to tell their stories. And it doesn't feel as like fresh from the pages as something like All the President's Men or The Conversation feels like. So it has more artistic license to kind of play with the idea of that kind of conspiracy without people drawing it as directly.
Yeah. And it does make me wonder how all three of these films really would be received in like a 2023 atmosphere. It's been a while since any like.
There's been. I think it's partially the trap that this kind of political thriller can become. They all want it to be All the President's Men. It can become. They're all very cliche. I think the last one I saw was about leaking the reports of abuse in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember what they're all very samey.
Yeah.
And it feels like they're just all Oscar bait that's looking for the prestige of tackling such issues without having any kind of genuine character exploration or meaningful exploration. Charlie Wilson's War is the last one I can really think of as having an impact on me, which I'm not going to say that Aaron Sorkin has the gift of subtlety, but it is compelling and it feels fresh.
Yeah.
That was also, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah. The way that the events of the movie have a direct personal impact on the characters does really sell like the emotional weight of the movie, with the death of Sally and the guilt that Jack now has to carry with the echo chamber of her like final scream ringing in his ears, the way that Harry Call just completely has a lapse in his grip of reality and is stuck with that at the end of the movie. Like it's a very emotional attachment without the story being necessarily about that, if that makes sense. You know, the stories are all very meticulous and mechanical and plot driven, but it's very it doesn't lose sight of the emotional qualities that you really need in a movie like this to have you walk away with an understanding of impact.
And in true noir fashion, both Jack and Sally have guilt that they're trying to atone for. They're trying to right past wrongs. You know, Jack, obviously, with the whole having getting a cop murdered through technical ineptitude, through technical failure. And Sally, with her having been a party to this rat fucking operation that got someone murdered, you know, got someone killed. They're both trying to make things right because they are good people, and we're able to honestly believe they're good people with quite a lot of earnestness, but they're just stuck with the guilt over these endless, these wrongs that they're never going to be able to overcome. So they just have to try to do their best.
Speaking of past wrongs that you can never get away from, The Lives of Others is our third movie. Lives of Others, is a more recent release. It came out in 2006. It has a 92% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. You can access a Sony Blu-ray in the US and a Lionsgate copy in the UK. There's a better encode on the UK, but they are region locked. The version of this film that we viewed was the UK version.
And it's not on subscription streaming services anywhere. So you're going to have to shell up some money either for a streaming rental or for the Blu-ray. The film did win an Academy Award for Best International Film, beating out Pan's Labyrinth to the surprise of a lot of people, and has numerous other critical successes, including many awards from the German film societies. This is the first film to come out of East Germany after the fall of the wall that really directly grapples with the kind of mass surveillance by the authoritarian regime on people in a serious tone. There were a couple films that dealt with it through comedy. This film does not deal with it through comedy. There is no comedy to be found here. This is a harrowing look at the personal effect of extended surveillance on people from the perspective of one of the Stasi agents who is conducting this surveillance. It stars Ulrich Muhy, Sebastian Koch, and Martina Gedeck in this very powerful character-driven drama. You want to tell us about it?
Oh, yes, I do. This was my favorite of the three. I'm just going to be biased and outright. So the story is set in 1984 East Germany with our main character, Stasi Captain Herd Wiesler, whose codename is HDWXX/7. He's ordered by a friend and colleague of his, Lieutenant Colonel Anton Grubitz, to spy on a playwright, George Drayman. George Drayman is a public pro-communist playwright. He has international recognition, but has really, generally speaking, been in the eyes of the state very unproblematic with his views and his perspectives in his writing. Drayman's appearance as a model citizen of East Germany mystifies Lieutenant Colonel Grubitz, and so he is naturally suspicious, and he wants Wiesler to set up an operation to spy on this playwright and learn more about him. The film, kind of the introduction to that Wiesler has to Drayman, is he goes to see one of his plays that is being performed. The lead in the play is Drayman's girlfriend, actress Christa Maria Seelen, who's played by Martina Gedeck. And throughout the play, the play is not especially important to the story, but while this play is going on, the two men are observing Drayman from the back of the theater. So Wiesler and his colleagues go to Drayman's apartment when he's not there to set up a very elaborate tap. They go into the wall sockets. They put lining in the walls. They map out the house. They map out the apartment. They get very careful details of every inch of this place. Every room is being listened to. Everything that happens in there is being recorded. And then we kind of, that does all the setup we need, and the story starts to unroll where, so Wiesler sets up shop in the attic of the apartment building with all of the equipment that he needs to listen in onto the lives of these people. Draymond and Krista return, and we start getting looks at their lives through both not just what Wiesler hears in their conversations at the apartment, but also we do follow these two characters and their personal lives beyond his range of surveillance. There's a few different plot elements here. Draymond has a colleague who is a director named Yuska, Albert Yuska, who is blacklisted basically from being able to direct. His career has essentially been frozen because of his political views, and he's viewed by the Stasis as being unfit to produce art in their republic. The film really does talk a lot about the repression of artists being only allowed to produce art that valued the state and was deemed correct by the state. So a lot of these actors, directors, and writers can essentially have their careers ripped out of their hands if they express a political view that goes against the grain.
Not even just a political view. We see artists whose politics coincide with the state's politics, but a criticism of the state itself in their function.
Yeah, this is immediately established to us as well as a very high stakes story. Anything that can be viewed as going against or even critiquing the state can have very deadly consequences. We open the movie on, importantly, a torture scene where random citizen is being interrogated by the Stasis to try and get him to reveal personal information about a neighbor and a friend who had fled the country. So, and then it introduces us to the fact that this is actually a recording that Wiesler's giving a lecture on at this academy. So it is shown to us very early on, Wiesler really believes in what he's doing and he's an expert at what he does. But it's also, the film really lets you know, like, the reality that these characters are living in very quickly.
Even in the one of the very first lines you hear in the film is "sit on your hands." And we later learn that that is so that they can collect the, so that when you're sweating in the interrogation, it all goes onto the seat. And they save the seat in a glass jar to be a sample for the dogs if they ever need to hunt you.
Yeah, it is a very unsettling opening to a movie. Now to fast forward back to where we left off on the plot. There's a lot of different things happening in these people's lives. Krista has a lot of issues going on in her life. She's struggling with drug abuse. She's in an abusive relationship with Minister Hempf, who is the Minister of Culture for the state. And we're also introduced to him earlier on in the movie. He also is attending the play that all the characters are kind of introduced at.
And ordered the observation.
Yes, he is the one who wants this operation done. And
you question his motives.
Yeah, his motives immediately when you realize that he is engaged with, you know, he's involved with Krista. Immediately, the fact that he's having this investigation done pulls him into question. Draymond is very model citizen. He has a birthday party, which invites a lot of his fellow artists, friends, writers, directors, etc., to the party, and he is a very, like, above board, by the book, conforming citizen, even though there's a lot of tension at that party because you have different artists there, some of whom are still able to produce art under the state and others who have been blacklisted, and there's a real tension between these people at this party. Yuska, who is his good friend, the director, is there. He gives him a gift of sheet music, which is Sonata for a Good Man. Yuska is a destroyed man. He is unable to move past the fact that he can no longer direct. He feels like his life is in ruins. And we later find out that but a few days later, he's died by suicide. This event really shakes Draymond. And he finds himself wanting to push against what he has always been following. He starts to get ideas that he should write about what has happened. He wants to write about the elevated suicide rates here that is happening in East Germany, because the country had stopped publishing their suicide rates, a couple years prior. He wanted to basically shine a light on this, and this is directly because of what has happened with his good friend Jirska. Of course, writing anything like this would be extremely dangerous, as it would reflect poorly on the state to send out an article to the rest of the world about the elevated suicide rates and how the fact that they have stopped reporting on them would reflect very poorly. It is a dangerous thing that he wants to do, but he feels that it is the right thing to do, and he conspires with some publishers and fellow friends of Jirska's to write this article. All this time, Wiesler has been listening in. He has been following the emotional turmoils that these characters have been going to. He's been vicariously experiencing the sorrow that Dreimann has had over the death of Jirska. He has been listening to the tormented cries of Krista after she has been sexually assaulted in a car by Hempf. He is very emotionally attached to the events that are happening to these two characters. He is developing a very strong parasocial relationship with these two people, and he is concerned for them because he also knows the direct dangers that they are in.
And when he breaks into the apartment to steal a copy of a book of Brecht's poetry. Brecht is a famously controversial East German poet who I believe would not have been viewed in a positive light at the time by the state.
So when Dreimann starts cooking up his plan to write this article, he first wants to try and establish whether or not his apartment is safe. So they essentially lay a trap because they have been living under the assumption that they are bugged at pretty much any personal location of theirs. So they basically set up an attempt to ensure that his apartment is not tapped, because they are naturally suspicious that they're under surveillance. Dreimann and his friends set up a trap for anyone who might be listening by saying that a friend of theirs is going to be smuggled out in a specific car under a seat, and that they won't get checked by border patrol, essentially, when trying to leave. This is obviously not really going to happen, but they wanted to see if the car was going to get searched. So the friend goes, drives, and doesn't have a problem, because Wiesler, who has heard all of this, decides not to do anything. He even goes to call his superiors because he's believing that this is a real smuggling thing that is happening, and then stops before he calls to report this. And instead, I believe he types on his report sheet, "Nothing of importance occurs." He is starting to feel deeply, he's deeply attached to these people, but this is, I believe, one of the first moments in the movie that he starts really interfering directly with the lives of these people. The other event that happened, I believe, but a few minutes prior in the movie, is Dreimann learns of Krista's affair with Hempf and is begging her to not go, not to leave him, not to put herself in the position she's been putting herself in. And she leaves. Wiesler has heard all of this, and he actually leaves his post where he's been surveying these two people to go and have a conversation with Krista. And in a conversation with her, that is a very weird moment where, like, if someone, you have a parasocial relationship, and then suddenly those two people meet in real life and have a conversation, it's that uncomfortable feeling of one character knowing way more about the other than they mm-hmm. should. And so you have this scene where Wiesler is so insightful into Krista's mental state and so insightful into, like, who she is, that he persuades her to go back to Dreimann and not to go to Hempf. But at the same time, you, the viewer, are left with this uncomfortable knowledge that he gained that information through, you know, espionage, through listening in to these two people.
Yeah, it presents to her as just a theater fan of hers being nosy, quite frankly. But there's something much more insidious that the audience is able to perceive.
Yeah. So Krista goes back to Dryman. And this, again, these, the actions that Wiesler takes with these people directly impacts them so heavily, because Hempf does not take well to the fact that Krista no longer is seeing him. He knows that she is taking illegal drugs. He turns her in. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Dryman and his colleagues are very, very careful about how they go about writing this article. They bring in a typewriter that's not even used in the country. They use red ink. They don't want the Stasi's to even be able to identify the typewriter that it belonged to. Dryman hides the typewriter that they've smuggled in under the floorboards in his apartment. Again, just the utmost level of caution is being taken, which is almost comedic, because you, the viewer, know that they're being surveyed at all times, and you know that at any given time, Wiesler could turn them in, but he doesn't. Continually, Wiesler obscures information in his reports, sympathizes with their problems, decides not to report what they've been doing, even though he has extremely damning evidence that would get all of these people killed. But the actions that he has taken do now have a spiraling effect. Hempf turns in Krista to Grubitz, and she is taken in for questioning. She is essentially blackmailed into revealing that Dryman is writing an article. She doesn't know explicitly that he is writing it. He hasn't told her directly, even though he tries to, but she walks in on him putting away the typewriter. And so she knows that something is up, but she also knows herself enough to feel like she shouldn't know. Because of Wiesler's silence, the article is published. The world suddenly knows about the suicide rates in East Germany. The world's talking about it. And this causes the Stasi's to really start to figure out who wrote this article, to really crack down. And obviously, suspect number one is Dryman. Wiesler is put in this really uncomfortable position now of, he has essentially listened to all this evidence. He knows everything, but he is hiding this information from his colleagues. But it almost feels like it comes to naught, because when Krista is taken in for questioning, she reveals that Dryman is the one who wrote the article, in a moment that is so interesting to me, because Grubitz knows that Wiesler is not being totally honest with him at this point. And so you have this really intense interrogation scene where Krista is being interrogated by Wiesler, and you can't even tell if she recognizes him from the bar earlier, or if she knows and she just accepts the fact that she has been surveyed all this time. She shouldn't be surprised that the, you know, person who spoke to her at this random bar with all this insightful knowledge was actually working for the state and is here to essentially end her career because of her actions. Wiesler essentially breaks her, and she reveals everything, and the Stasi's head over to Dryman's apartment to take the typewriter, this final piece of damning evidence. And we get there, and the typewriter's not under the floorboards. We know from earlier on that Wiesler had left the interrogation immediately to go to the site for the operation. He also, we see him outside of the building, but we don't know where he's been or what he's done between leaving the interrogation and the arrival of the rest of his colleagues. They search the apartment top to bottom. They find nothing. It's important to note that they had already done this previously because of the high suspicion of, like, Dryman. He was pretty much the number one suspect for being the author of this article. So the second time around, though, they know to go straight to the floor and rip it up to reveal no typewriter. Krista has returned home. She's now an informant of the state, and so they've let her go. They don't feel any need to keep her in custody because they know she'll keep in line now. So she is also at the apartment, and she realizes in that moment that Dryman will know that she's the one who told them. And she runs out of the apartment into the street and is hit by a car. Meanwhile, in the apartment, Grubitz, because he has found nothing, no typewriter or any kind of evidence to show that Dryman was the author, effectively clears him and says that the operation is over. He's, you know, free to go about his life, which has obviously been irreversibly destroyed. We see Dryman hugging a bloodied Krista in the street, sobbing because this is the woman he loved and his life has been torn apart by essentially the actions of his country and the actions of his state, which he is, again, to emphasize, he is in favor of. He is a loyal comrade. Grubitz knows that Veebler has been screwing with evidence, has been messing with this operation, has been obfuscating information, and he is punished duly for this. He's basically demoted from any kind of surveillance work. He's forced to work opening letters of citizens, looking for incriminating evidence in people's personal letters to one another. And that's when we find him 4 years later, when the wall is, when the wall falls.
I think it's important to note that when Grubitz tells Weissler that he will spend the rest of his life opening letters because he, while there's no evidence, he believes him to be untrustworthy. He is holding a newspaper announcing that Gorbachev has been elected the leader of the Soviet Union. So we can kind of get the feeling that the eternity is not eternal, shall we say. The facade is beginning to crumble on the entire regime.
So we fast forward to 1989. Wiesler is working steam opening letters with a previous colleague from his previous line of work who'd also fallen afoul of the regime at Wiesler's own hand. He was one of the people who removed this colleague. And his colleague has been listening to the radio, and he tells him that about the fall of the Berlin Wall, and all of the people in that room just get up and walk out because it's over. We then move forward 2 more years into the future. Hempf and Dreimann are at a performance of the same play that we opened the story with, except that the person performing it is no longer Krista, obviously. And it gets too emotional for both of them, so they both step out of the play. And Dreimann turns to Hempf and says, why was I never tapped? Why were you never listening to me? And that's when Hempf tells him, oh, we knew everything. We had you tapped every minute of your life in that room. And Dreimann, up until the moment, hadn't realized that his apartment had been tapped this whole time. So he runs home and he finds the, like, old listening devices in the apartment, and you get this scene of him just very methodically removing each of these wiretaps, and you again get a sense of the scale of the invasion of these items in his home, in his bathroom, by the wall sconce in the living room. And he's just left to know that someone has been listening, but he also knows that someone's been listening, and he had made no secret in the apartment that about what they were doing. So he goes to the Stasi records agency to read about the, like, files now that they had been keeping on various people that they had under surveillance. And he goes through reading these reports about his life and Krista's life. He finds contradictions. He sees, you know, he lived these moments. He knows that what has been written down in these reports is not completely accurate. He sees that the Stasi officer HGW-XX7 has been the one making all these notes and then suddenly is removed from the reports. But he knows that that is the person who has been listening to him this whole time and the person who chose not to report him. Dreimann does go to discover the identity of Wiesler. He even tries to track him down. He finds him. Wiesler is now working as a mailman. But ultimately, Dreimann decides not to approach him and instead gets back in the car and leaves. Another 2 years later, Wiesler is passing a bookstore with Dreimann's newest book called Sonata for a Good Man. He goes in the store to see the book by this person, again, that he had been so involved in the life of. And in the dedication, it says to HGW-XX7 in gratitude. And he goes to buy a copy, and we are left with the bookstore seller asking if he would like a gift wrapped for someone else. And he looks back and he says, no, it's for me, which is an incredible ending. But it also leaves you with the way that Dreimann puts together the fact that Veebler has, you know, listened to all of that and said nothing, essentially protected him. But at the same time, Veebler also is in many ways directly responsible for the death of Krista. And Dreiman does not know that.
Yeah, I think he can infer that based on the reports he's reading. Because he also, remember, he has Krista's interrogation there, which is also
I hadn't thought of that.
By Weebler. And then he sees that the final report has her blood literally on it.
Yeah.
So, like, I think he's able to appreciate the complexity of it in, through inference.
Yeah. Ultimately, though, he does know that Weebler had the power to...
destroy them all.
Destroy them all, and he didn't.
I also think it's an interesting conversation on the parasocial aspects of their relationship, that when given a chance, Dreiman does not approach him because he doesn't actually know him. He just knows him through his records. So it's kind of an inversion of the relationship that we've seen from the other side.
I also think it's interesting because the events of the movie are very much split. You split a lot of time between different characters because we don't just follow Weebler.
Mm-hmm.
We follow Dreiman and his planning of writing the article. We follow him and his relationships outside of the story. And we also follow Krista outside of the surveillance that Weebler is getting. So in a way, in this movie, Weebler doesn't have all the information. He has, of course, the very damning stuff that he overhears in the apartment that he could have used to destroy them all. But even him, with his parasocial relationship and this very like tight attachment that he has developed for these two people, he still doesn't have the whole picture.
Yep. And it also shows through, like, some of his associates are really not capturing the heart of what's going on with these characters from because they're even less invested than he is. So it kind of addresses how one dimensional this kind of observation can be. I also think, you know, all three of these films deal with guilt, but I think Weebler's guilt here is interesting because it's not just his own personal reflections on his own involvement, but it's also speaking to like a national guilt. Something that last scene at the theater is really touching on of, you know, the old bureaucrat saying that, well, today Germany has no culture, but kind of throwing back that also like Germans are not living in fear of their government anymore. And like that is a weight that everyone carries as a citizen. You know, we see how many people get sucked into being complicit in these crimes. You know, his kindly neighbor is forced to reveal, is forced to conceal his surveillance. Everyone on some level plays a part to the machine that is the authoritarian regime. So therefore, everyone shares their own burden of guilt.
Yeah, the tension and like palpable, you know, almost fear that everybody in this government is living under throughout this story. Because even if you say just the one wrong thing out of line, it can have terribly dire consequences for you, for the people that you love. There is a incredibly tight amount of tension throughout this entire movie. And you are not really given any relief from it because you don't have any way of knowing how it's going to go. I think this movie is a lot more emotional than the other two films here. This is a way more like character driven story. With the very emotional attachment that Weebler develops towards these two people, but also a lot of time is put into showing how tormented Krista is and how much like Dreiman is struggling with the death of his Yuska. Like it's a real, the movie takes time to show you the very lived consequences of like this government.
It's a true ensemble piece. Every character is unique, but building to a larger narrative, as they're each going through their own individual lives, which are very fleshed out. I also think this film is not afraid of using narrative devices. to advance itself. It is not a like stripped down realist film, like The Conversation. And it's not also like the hyper stylized version of, you know, neo-noir, like Blowout. It uses a lot of visual devices to reinforce the conformity of this world of East Germany, through the architecture, through the, you know, interior design, through the just the conformity in how people engage in conversations that might be overheard. Everything's very rigid. Even, quite frankly, the theater feels rigid. We get a real sense that that it feels oppressive through those subtle notes of showing us these lives.
I think it's really interesting that this story centers around like artists and the creation of art and the very like stark repression that you like feel with all these characters throughout the story. There's a really heartbreaking part where Wiesler is talking with Grubitz, and Grubitz is talking about various interrogation techniques and things like that. And he was talking about how like, oh, there's only like a certain number of types of artists. Yeah. And he basically talks about how what type
there are six.
Dreyman is.
There are six pathologies of artists.
Six pathologies of artists, and Dreyman is a type four. And he like lists out exactly what like the best way to deal with someone like Dreyman would be.
Yeah, you dehumanize him, but don't give him any kind of actual like direct trauma that he can write about.
Yeah. And then and it's just the total coldness and understanding of human psychology and the total emotionless, like Grubitz is excited that he like has this technique or whatever, but he has like there's no human indication that he has any kind of emotional guilt for like what he's been doing.
He's proud of it. It makes him look good at his job.
Yeah,
his
he takes
career.
Pride in his work. He takes pride in his work. And then they talk about how, you know, many people who go through these techniques never write again. Yeah. These artists.
And that's presented as a positive for the state.
Yeah, Grubitz presents that as a positive. And we're there with Wiesler. And, you know, he has come into that room in that scene actually to spill the beans, to finally reveal everything. And that conversation with Grubitz is what makes him change his mind. And he sort of just folds the envelope away back into his pocket because he's decided he can't go through with this. But what a awful like loss of art and creation is what I was left thinking about in that scene.
It's
things that will never be written because of these events.
And like the ways, you know, some of the greatest art of the 20th century came from the Soviet bloc. And you have to imagine for every voice that was able to stick it out and tell their stories and be appreciated, not only within their nation, but also in the West, 10 more were probably snuffed out. You know, we're going to be talking about the Czech New Wave in a couple weeks. And it's remarkable how tales of resistance have real stakes because they were made under great threat. I think that's kind of like the lasting takeaway of The Lives of Others is not just that like freedom of speech is incredibly important to society, but that freedom of art specifically and freedom of expression, once you start to selectively remove that, a lot of artists will just give up. And that's you lose culture, you lose what makes a society, you know, colorful and rich and has identity. I think The Lives of Others is an absolute masterpiece that captures a lens of a time with so much integrity and so much heart. You can tell that these are, you know, filmmakers who went through this world and were affected by it, and that authenticity really feels very, very direct in this movie.
Yeah, you never feel for a moment like, you know, it's a movie, but at the same time, it is so grounded in reality. You know, this happened. This kind of thing happened. You aren't allowed the like relief of it being a fictional story in many ways. you have to sit with that. You have to sit with the fact that, you know, real people, you know, these specifically weren't real people, but they were proxies for real people.
And it's not afraid to, and it's not afraid to use narrative elements to enhance telling the story, but that doesn't make you, it doesn't feel insincere when it does that. It feels like it's bettering the way that it's telling the story to represent the lives of these people.
Yeah. And I also find it interesting. It's titled The Lives of Others.
There's a couple of, different angles to that.
There are several, yeah, different angles you can take with that. Like when I think about it, it's the way the Wiesler is invited to look outside of himself and to look into the lives of these people, but also the fact that these people are normal people,
mm-hmm.
you know, actor, writer, they're just normal citizens. And he's pulled into their lives, observing them, who they are, you know, the mundane sides of their relationship together, but then also the trauma and the grief and the conflict about what is the right thing to do.
But you,
the viewer, also observing the lives of other people.
And you see kind of how dehumanized that can be into just what is, you know, exciting from a voyeur's perspective in how his night relief treats it. You know, it's just what it, mm-hmm. you know, an interest in what they're getting up into in the bedroom. He's so desensitized to actually looking at the interpersonal lives, while for some reason Weisler is intensely interested in this case, and he sees the minutia of their lived experience in a way that a lot of the other people around him don't.
Yeah, he is forced by this operation to take a look at lives outside of himself. You know, the nature of his work is to do that. But in this case, he is so profoundly affected by it that he is unable to go through with what you are assumed to believe in previous, you know, jobs and in previous operations he has, you know, done many times, he would have gone through with. And the profound, like, very, I don't know, emotional impact of that really, like, sits with you afterwards.
Yeah. I also find it interesting that he becomes a mail carrier. Which is kind of like, it's weird because, like, a mail carrier is trusted with a lot of secrets that they yes. do not open. They do not delve into, in theory. You know, they're a mail carrier is like a respected bastion of privacy in a lot of Western society. So it's kind of like that. It's that journey that he's taken from being a spy to being someone who's viewed as a very trustworthy figure. Well, that wraps up our discussion for today. We hope you've enjoyed exploring these films with us. Please be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Audible, and give us 5 stars on those, and as well as Spotify. It really helps us a lot. You can email us with some feedback at framesofreference@bravevoicefilms.com. Sarah, what are we checking out next time?
So in our next episode, we are going to be doing a deep dive on director Alfonso Cuarón, and we'll be looking at his films Y Tu Mama También, Children of Men, and Roma.
Hope you enjoyed it, and goodbye for now.
See you next time.